This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Mike Best. How are you, Mike?
Very good, Chris. Nice to be here.
What we want to talk about today is why some wines sell and others don't, or particularly some grape varieties perhaps as well. Some are more popular, some aren't. But before we get into that, what do you think you can answer that question? I know you're a master of wine.
That's a good question. I mean, this is sort of what I think about every day. I think, my job is that I am product manager or buyer, but we call them product managers at Boutinot, so a UK-based wine importer distributor. I'm principally looking after Iberia, England, and Lebanon, with a lot of time working in independent wine scenes. But we, you know, sell to all different channels, and so that essentially is what I think about every day. When you look at wines, and you think that certain wines are going to do really well, and maybe they do, or maybe they don't, and trying to understand that. And we're here at London Wine Fair. There's many people downstairs who want to sell their wines in the UK who aren't. Why aren't there queues of people outside their stand trying to buy their wines? Or why in some, you know, but some people will be very successful here. Why is that? It's something that I work on pretty much every day.
Yeah, okay. All right. So why then?
Why then? Well, it's a big question, but it's interesting to think about it in terms of the number of factors and the styles and the changes and the fashions, and there's so many moving parts in this. So maybe I was thinking this is a good topic of conversation because it's something that I would like to know the answer to. But thinking about the style and the way that wines have changed, so one example would be in Spain and Portugal. There has been a history in the past of seeing that principally red wine producing countries that see power in terms of the style of the wine as being a thing that is there for quality, and the more powerful the wine is, the more expensive it is. Okay, but this is true still in some areas, but is changing in that people are looking more for more finesse and elegance. I tried downstairs today a Monastrell wine, which is very pure, more Pinot Noir-like, very finessed, and you think this is fantastic to see that the people are going down this way, compared to sort of big, over-extracted, too ripe, too alcoholic, too tannic as well, in the intention that, oh, well, power will be the thing that we will use to sell the wine. So that's one element, that sort of stylistic element. However, I have to caveat that, this is a dichotomy, I have to caveat that with the idea that the still very, very popular wines are the ones that are very ripe, have good fruit sweetness, maybe even a bit of residual sugar, and those wines will sell fantastically well. So despite what, with all the greatest respect to wine journalists, what they say in terms of people want lighter, fresher, more delicate, look at how much Passamento wine is sold in the UK. It's how much Zinfandel is sold in the UK. All, you know, these wines that are like that, sort of rich, and 19 Crimes would be another good example of, like, so despite what people want, what actually sells is this style. But it depends where you're selling it and who you're selling it to. Lots and lots and lots of factors that I've sort of shouted out there as reasons why some wines sell and other wines don't.
I think, it depends on your audience, isn't it? Because I think sometimes people, particularly the people who aren't fully engaged with the product like category like we are, or wine journalists, or, you know, the deciders of taste, if you like. You know, a lot of people like big, rich, gutsy wines. You know, the number of people, because I run a lot of tastings, number of people who tell me, you know, they look at the legs because that's a sign of quality. You know, legs is a sign of alcohol level. When alcohol gives you an idea of the body, and so therefore legs are a sign of the size of the wine in the mouth. And they're thinking, this is good wine because it's got lots of legs. And they know they like the wine because it's got the legs. But really all they're saying is, I like big, gutsy wines. And I think early on, if you're into red wines, once you get over tannins, which is always a big stumbling block for most people, is once they get over that, the next step is the bigger the better.
Yeah.
And then maybe later on, I think you see people then looking for more finesse or more subtlety or more acidity in the wines, perhaps. Yeah. I don't know. And that, for me, I look at that more as an evolution of the consumer through their drinking progress.
Yeah. And so that's one element of it. So exactly what you said, this consumer evolution in terms of style and the way that people go. And sometimes for me as well, just a sort of side note, sometimes when I come back to sort of a big gutsy red wine, I actually find it quite kind of nostalgic in some ways, and sometimes quite nice. But like, you know, I haven't drunk, or like Marlborough Sauvignon, for example. Like I cannot remember when I, probably 10 years ago, the last time I actually opened and drank a bottle of one of the UK's most popular and most profitable selling wines. But when would I ever drink one at home? Almost never. But actually sometimes...
Oh, I do.
You do. That's, yeah, that's good. That's, yeah, I did actually buy some for my mum and have some with her, which is nice. But people, you know, go through these changes, which is important. The consumer, though, is probably where we start, but it's only a tiny bit of the story. I think it's, in some ways, it is the tip of the iceberg. The bit which is underneath, I would say, if you look at the biggest thing first, would be the distribution model, right? In terms of why does a wine get sold or not? Well, mostly because of where it's available for sale. So that would be a very important piece, because obviously if the wine, you can't actually buy it, then how would it possibly be popular? So in terms of where then the wines get listed in certain restaurants or in certain wine shops, a lot of that comes down to the quality of the wine, of course, but actually it comes down to relationships between salespeople and owners of, or people who make decisions on wine lists or what's going to go on a shelf. That would be very important.
An example of that might be why the Italians dominate the restaurant trade, but the Aussies dominate the supermarket trade.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that in itself, I never really thought about it in that way before, but actually, yes, I mean, because there's so many people who are of Italian heritage who are influential in the London wine scene, and therefore may have a predisposition to Italian sales, you know, people who work for UK wine companies selling Italian wine or of Italian heritage, and it just sort of seems to fit. And then the people who were sort of good in the FMCG world selling wine to supermarkets, yeah, was a lot of Australasia. So that could be like a very important and sort of, in some ways, kind of obvious but often forgotten point about, well, that's why it is. But if I was thinking about why does one wine get sold over another, when there are so many different factors, the distribution network would probably be probably the most important thing. That leads you on to the next question, which is, well, how does a wine get into the distribution network? So that would be question number two, I suppose.
Yeah, but fashion must play a part. You know, if you tried to sell an Oaky Chardonnay 20 years ago, you didn't have much chance, whereas, you know, 30 years ago, trying to sell a Pinot Grigio, you'd have no chance at all.
Yeah.
But fashion does seem to change.
Yeah.
And the wine trade, the thought police, if you like, they don't necessarily drive the fashion as much as they think they do.
No.
So what's driving that? You know, why is Oaky Chardonnay so popular then? Went through quite a almost loathing period for a lot of people. Maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, it's coming back out now.
Yeah,
but
interesting. What drives fashion, which is another important element. I mean, your point on Oaky Chardonnay, I've noticed at a few consumer tastings where I've been that from the younger crowd, they don't have this hang-up about Oaky Chardonnay,
no.
Which is brilliant. Whereas if you see someone who's maybe, you know, 50 plus, say, then they would say, oh, no, not if it's oaked, because they remember that. And probably the people who are sort of, against Blue Nun are in their 70s. So this is all moved on. It's nice that people don't have that Oaky Chardonnay baggage, because of course it can be done well or badly. So that's fine. In terms of fashion, what the next big thing is, I think that one point that I can't remember who made it to me, but thinking that it has to be there in big enough volume already.
Yes.
So people talk about alternative varieties in New Zealand. Let's just take one small example and say Gruner Veltliner could be the next big thing in New Zealand. It's like, it won't be, because there isn't any planted. There isn't a tap which can be turned on. 70% of the wine is Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough. That's why it's the big thing. If there is, and so what it would require is looking around the world to see where is there a lot of vineyards where the wines are kind of anonymous now, but they have a lot of a certain grape variety planted that be like, okay, well, that could come into something which is there. Bearing in mind that the average price of a bottle of wine in the UK is just over £6. So that's terrifying, but it's also reality. And just over 2% of the wines sold are over £10 retail. Again, a terrifying statistic, but it's also reality. So you need to fit within, if you want to be the next big thing, you have to fit within those parameters.
I always used to think, well, when I first got into the trade, I used to think Nera d'Avila would be the next big thing, because it had lots of, it wasn't overly rich, but it had lots of generosity to it. It wasn't particularly tannic. It was a little bit, I always think of it as like the Italian Merlot, you know, a little bit mediumitis that everybody will just love.
Yeah.
And I think that whole thing about there just wasn't enough Nera d'Avola for it to really tannic. Yeah. I think it makes up 1% of Italian production, which is...
Still a lot of wine, but yeah.
But it's not enough to really...
Has to have a critical mass.
Through, yeah. So critical mass, you need a lot of critical mass, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay. And I suppose that's why things like Sauvignon Blanc, it, you know, the last 15 years, it's had New Zealand banging out a lot of stuff, but you've got South Africa.
Yeah.
You've got the historical stuff from Bordeaux and the Loire Valley. And Australians try, bless them.
still working on that one, aren't they?
But there's, in Chile, for example. So there is a lot of volume there. And a lot of different volume as well.
And actually, I'll just take up your point on Sauvignon Blanc, because one of the things that benefited from the MW course is from getting this global recognition of wine. And I remember in one tasting there being a Napa Sauvignon Blanc being put in, but it wasn't an oaked one, it wasn't a Fumé Blanc, so it was quite anonymous in some ways. And all of the Europeans had literally no idea. It's like, well, we all got it as Sauvignon Blanc because it's not like Sauvignon, put it in different countries, none of which were California. Hadn't even thought about it. And that wine, if it was, I don't remember the brand, I wouldn't say, it was a fairly anonymous wine. It was like, if you were at the IWC, it would probably get a commended or a bronze, no more. And it would be about £25 retail in the UK. And so you think, how on earth is that possible? But the reason why that sells is because of the of how it works in California, with what the price of the wine is, what people are prepared to pay, how it's sold, if it's sold, you know, often as well, sort of via a cellar door or via a brand which can support marketing activity. But if you walked into a wine shop and bought that in the UK with how competitive it is and how much great wine you could buy at £25, you will be really disappointed. But there's many, many people who are buying that in America who are obviously very happy with it because it's a very popular brand. So
sometimes being niche in a region is enough for it to become popular. So, for example, New Zealand Serra is very good, don't get me wrong, but for a long time it was incredibly niche. You know, you'd get a bit of Pinot, you'd get a bit of Savvy, and then you'd see a little bit of Serra and you go, oh, no, it's pretty good. And it was popular because it was a little bit niche. Now there's a bit more Serra coming on, so that's one element. And the other element is marketing and brand. That's got to be huge. You look at 19 Crimes and they've taken what is not bad wine, you know, high volume commercial stuff, there's nothing wrong with them, but they've just gone gangbusters over the last 10 years or 5 years, and it's amazing what they've managed to do in terms of volumes.
Yeah, so they've clearly worked out, you know, that's just been very smart people who are actually experts in marketing and branding turning up with a proposition which is going to work, and that is absolutely, you know, kudos to them. You know, it's very successful. So we won't get into the Yellowtail debate, which sort of, if anyone, some wine Twitter will see, it sort of caused a massive rift. But Yellowtail debate on wine Twitter, which was the basic premise of the argument is Yellowtail is bad for wine because it's cheap, and if you try it, you'll think it's horrible. And other people say, no, these are perfectly good wines which allow people to get into wine in a sort of uncomplicated way. And that's the sort of, you know, that's the very sort of low resolution argument.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I use it in a WSD course, and I compare that to a Crozes Hermitage.
Right, okay.
Similar price point. Everybody prefer, 90% prefer Yellowtail. Yeah. Then you tell them what the brand is, and then they're like, oh, it's hard to row back from it. But you give it to them blind.
Why not?
And the Shiraz, it's got a really dominant clove note to the Shiraz, and, you know, it's quite nice. Yeah, I don't mind the wine, but I can see why people don't like getting it. And there's a lot of people who, you know, if the wine's not super expensive, then, you know, what's wrong? Why is this wine even being allowed to be sold?
Yeah, for sure. Because we've spent most of the time talking more or less about sort of entry-level sort of wines, if you take this to the really the super premium stuff as well, then I think that is there's another sort of fascinating insight into it, wine sales are not it's not a linear distribution model. It's a Pareto distribution, meaning that there are some people who sell their wine at fantastically expensive prices, and most people sell them at nothing. And a great example of this will be Bordeaux, where there's 200 wines sold on the Place de Bordeaux, and they get all the money.
Yeah.
Then there's 6,000 growers in Bordeaux, and so there's 5,800 growers that aren't within the Place de Bordeaux, and the average price of Medoc Rouge is what, €1, €1.50 XLR. So it's nothing compared to, you know, going through Primeurs now. So people are releasing their wines for fantastic prices, and so there's a lesson there, is that you can't just be good enough, you have to be the best, and that is a competition, because you can't all be the best. And so that's why people fight so hard, tooth and nail, the sort of these very high-end estates and you know, other groups around the world that are involved in these sort of luxury wines, because it's all about prestige. Because if you're not the best, you're completely sunk. And I think that's another sort of lesson as well in why wines sell.
I think prestige is probably, what, especially when it comes to the fine wines, what really sets the price has nothing to do with the quality in the bottle.
Yeah.
The quality in the bottle's got to be very good. That's the starting point.
Yeah.
But if you want to go from 100 quid to £1,000, yeah, it's all prestige. It's entirely that supply and demand and prestige is just driving it.
So yeah, so I thought that was also another point worth saying, because we spoke a lot about entry level wine. So why at the high end? Because, you know, sometimes some wineries, they sell out of one particular winery. They make a Pinot Noir that is happening in Germany actually, with some of the wines where the Pinot Noirs sell out really fantastically quickly, but the Rieslings are still a bit of a struggle. But yeah,
you sort of said about the German Pinot Noir. I'm going to hopefully interview a Welsh producer,
okay,
who made a reasonably decent Pinot Noir by all accounts, got a gold medal at Decanter. All of a sudden, bang, sold out. And competitions, if a wine keeps doing very well in a competition, it's got to at least open the door for people. And that goes back to your distribution channel as well. You know, how do you get your foot in the door in certain places to get the prestige? You know, you'll see a lot of, you know, Boutonneux, who you work for, you know, I bet they spend a lot of time cultivating relationships with the top restaurants because they want to get their wines into the top restaurants and because that has that whole prestige. Yeah. So do you want to comment?
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, that's definitely part of what we do, and hopefully not in a Machiavellian way, but like in a real way. I mean, one of the things that I like, this is not a sales pitch about Boutonneux, this is actually true, that we don't have wines that we have to sell. And that's quite a revolutionary statement for lots of wine companies. So the job is build a relationship with your customers, find out what they want, and then, because we've got a big portfolio, give them what they want from that. And that's not particularly complicated, but so many people get het up on saying, oh, well, this winery wants us to sell this amount and we sold less than last year. So so that, I think, is very important. The point about the awards is that, yeah, for sure. I mean, I had a Gadeo, which won a gold medal at Decanter, which we don't sell, but we work with the winery, and this is like their top Gadeo. But we don't import it, but now I want to, because I know that we can sell it because it's got the medal. I've never actually tasted that wine before this vintage, so I didn't know that it was going to win that medal. But it definitely does work in that sense. I mean, sometimes, but for different markets, different things work. So in the UK, Decanter, IWC, IWSC, these, I think, independent wine shop buyers and restaurants pay some attention to it. No one cares, with the best will in the world to him, I've never met him, what James Suckling thinks about any wines. I'm sure they do in Asia. I'm sure they do in the US. Sometimes wineries in Spain send me that they got 94 points James Suckling, and it means absolutely nothing. I'm not saying that negatively. I'm just saying that it's just not relevant for people. Don't know about it. So those are things that, whereas if Jancis gives a wine 18 points, you know, it's a huge score, and that means something in this market. Maybe in other markets it doesn't, but it's just
that's sort of about individual wines. We've been talking about why wines do or don't sell, etc., but what's the next grape, man? We've done Chardonnay, we've done Pinot Grigio.
Yeah,
what's next?
I need to be put on the spot here quickly about what's next.
Is there anything that you think, where there's volume and there's traction.
Varietal Tempranillo could be a big one, or Garnacha, you know, Grenache. I think these two, because there's lots of it, and they're waiting. The revolution is waiting to happen, or it is happening, I suppose, in both of those varieties, but maybe in a more mainstream way. I would say is waiting to happen. So I think that is that might be a sort of quick answer there.
Yeah. Tempranillo is a little bit Spanish, but the Aussies have a fair bit.
Yeah.
And Grenache is everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you could make it in different styles that people can understand. So, yeah.
Oh, well, we'll see. I'll hold you to it, mate, and we'll see you in 10 years.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much for your time.
Great talking to you.
Cheers, bud.